today I wanted to bring on someone to talk about a brand new product. If you are drinking water out of the tap, let me tell you, you've got to switch over to Paleo Water from Ultra Stream. It's the water we're designed to drink. And today we have Ian Blair Hamilton all the way from Australia telling us why we need Paleo Water. Ian, tell us.
G'day, Jimmy. Well, it's pretty simple, really. We are drinking water that's nothing like we drank in paleo days. And when you remember that 70% of your body is water, we can do only so much on the paleo diet. And we've done it. We love the paleo diet. But we realized that the water that our ancestors drank, you know, their life revolved around water. They found a good source of water and they lived near it and they defended it. But what was that water really like? Of course it was more pure than it is today.
Yeah.
But here's the big thing. When water seeps through alkaline minerals, particularly magnesium, it gets hydrogenated. It gets high hydrogen levels. And a good example of this is the Nordenau Springs in Western Germany, where people go along and drink the water and they have tremendous effect, particularly for diabetics and people with high inflammation. So we had the opportunity to design a brand new water filter. We've been doing this for 13 years. We call it the UltraStream, but it produces high hydrogen levels. And hydrogen is a selective antioxidant. It's the best antioxidant you can possibly have because it doesn't just scoop up all the good and bad free radicals. It scoops up the free radicals that you need to scoop up, the baddies only. That's an amazing thing. It's also hugely anti-inflammatory, and we are getting so many amazing stories from people just from drinking this water.
Well, they don't call it H2O for nothing, so people can find it at paleowater.info. Coming up in episode 731, Dr. Jadis Karazian.
It's the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And now, here's Jimmy.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And we do have the great Dr. Jadis Karazian on with us today. And he's got a brand new book out. It's called Why Isn't My Brain Working? A Revolutionary Understanding of Brain Decline and Effective Strategies to Recover Your Brain's Health. Now, you might recall Dr. Karazian was on way back in 382 to talk about his thyroid book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Tests Are Normal? We did a special thyroid week that week. And Dr. Karazian, I got to tell you, I appointed more people to that little podcast we did way back in 2010 because people, you know, were having frustrations with their thyroid and all the numbers would come back and, you know, really frustrated. So thank you so much for doing that resource. I'm glad to see you've moved on a bit from the thyroid, although I know you're helping a lot of people still with that issue, but the brain health issue is another biggie, so I'm glad you're tackling it.
Yeah, you know, the brain is one of the areas that is most overlooked, and, you know, for me, I'm not in particular into one area. I mean, not only focused on thyroid. The point is that when people become chronically ill, one of the areas that's typically overlooked is the health of the brain. And when you look at the most prescribed medications, and you see antidepressants and many types of mood-altering types of medications in an attempt to try to get people to function better, that we know we have a problem. So
yeah.
In the current model, you know, we don't have anyone really looking at brain health because neurology is really designed for end-stage neurological disease diagnosis, and no one else does anything, including natural medicine practitioners.
Although we are starting to see some bits and pieces, a pretty major book just released called Grain Brain from a neurologist who is identifying, you know, some of these issues that you talked about in your book. So it's really encouraging to see that.
Yeah, that book was by David Perlmutter. He's
yep.
one of my functional medicine colleagues, and we just had a conference together speaking. He's one of the special neurologists out there. And, you know,
the few, the proud.
He's very frustrated with his field as well.
That's
I mean,
right.
He's, you know, the point is there are exceptions. There are amazing people out there. He's one of them. And, but for the most part, the average human being that is not feeling well, isn't functioning well, if they have any brain impairments, they really have very little hope.
Yeah.
So the reason I pictured topics is really what things are people not getting. So the reason I first wrote the thyroid book was because most people have thyroid disorders and they're trying to treat it as a nutrient deficiency or just a single replacement model. But in fact, the mechanism is autoimmune. Unless you can handle the autoimmunity of it, you can't really address it.
Yeah.
The other major issue we have right now is we have an explosion of brain degeneration issues.
Right.
We have 1 out of 8 children that has autism or dyslexia or ADD or some type of learning disorder, and we have absolutely nothing for it. Mm. And when we look at even the key thing with this, it's early diagnosis. But there is no early diagnosis. There's just basically end-stage diagnosis.
Yeah.
But if a person has memory decline, if a person has depression, if a person is not able to find words and is not able to focus, these are all clues that there's something wrong with the brain. You know?
Right.
And that was the whole attempt with this. So it's a serious problem. And I know that a lot of your listeners are very much interested in carbohydrates and insulin,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I think the ketogenic diet, especially when it comes to brain health, is kind of getting a lot of attention, in recent years, thanks to people like Dr. Perlmutter and different other ones that are kind of saying, hey, you want that clarity of mind, cut the carbs.
Absolutely, and one of the things we know is just when people overeat carbohydrates, they get that brain fog and they want to crash. I mean, that's an insulin-related mechanism. That has immediate consequences on brain. That's created an inflammatory cascade.
Yeah.
So when you have people who eat meals and they pass out and they can't function afterwards, and the reason they can't function, if you really think about it, they're not able to use their brain. They can't concentrate, think. All they want to do is close their eyes.
Yeah.
There's an immediate attack on brain when people overeat. Or have carbohydrate or insulin surges, and that is something that gets overlooked. People don't realize if they've been doing that for years and years and years, they've had years and years and years of accelerated brain degeneration.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden they can't find their way home, or they need a navigation system to work. They don't realize that they're all those years of doing those dietary habits, they've perpetuated Alzheimer's or other types of dementias.
Sounds like in recent years you shifted focus just a bit to take a look at this brain health. What was it about brain health issues that you thought needed the attention that you gave to thyroid before?
Well, when you look at thyroid sufferers really truly have in many times no place to go.
Right.
In the current healthcare model, they go in, they finally get diagnosed, and they get a single simple pill model where you take this replacement and then we'll check up with you every year. But that's not really enough for most of these patients. And then we have the natural medicine world, which is really simplifying these things as being an iodine deficiency issues or basic nutrient issue. But the key thing with 90% of all known hypothyroid is that it was autoimmune. And one of the frustrations I had was I could, in my own clinical practice, see dramatic improvements of patients that were dealing with hypothyroid from doing dietary lifestyle nutritional intervention to really just go after their autoimmunity instead of their thyroid.
Right.
And over a 10-year period, I was teaching this all over the country and also internationally, and practitioners were learning the approach and getting effects, but I wasn't reaching enough people, and the goal of the book was to really get information out to the public, and I think that
mission accomplished. Yeah.
Mission accomplished, and many people really seem to have been helped by it, and it was just a phenomenal warm feeling. And this led me to the brain book, because just like I saw a major area of lack of hope for people that have thyroid disorders in the current healthcare model, there's also a lack of hope for people that have brain-related disorders, and they also truly have nowhere to go. Because when you really look at the outcomes of antidepressants and how long it takes for people to get diagnosed, they really end up worth thinking that there's nothing they can do. And we also have a major gap in between what conventional healthcare practitioners and even alternative healthcare practitioners do for early signs of brain. And there's many things people can do beyond just like taking fish oils or something.
You know? Yeah. You know what I think one of the biggest travesties in brain health today that most people have no clue is statin drugs. I think more people are taking those medications, all for the sake of their heart health, and the unexpected, the unintended consequence is more and more neurodegeneration, more and more mental decline, more and more Alzheimer's being induced by this. Are you seeing that?
Well, yeah, you know, we have a model where people have dysglycemia, they have abnormal dietary habits that have an impact on their lipid panels, especially triglycerides and other markers. And, we have a healthcare model that in a way has become, how do you want to call it, idiotic?
Yeah.
The single symptom, single pill model is not a respect for physiology. And, you know, people sometimes think that a scientific method with one linear variables to create an outcome from a group of select people compared to control is the way you determine healthcare, but that's limited in the extent of how you limit it. So when you look at people that go on a statin and there's evidence behind that it may reduce numbers, there's far-reaching effects of why the numbers were off in the first place and whether the statins themselves are the only variables, and even if they even have major impacts. And I think you just wrote a book on that, didn't you?
I did. Yep.
Yeah.
Cholesterol Clarity.
So, I mean, I think it's great for people like you to get the information out there. But one thing is pretty clear. I mean, it's one of the most successful pharmacological agents ever produced, you know, by human species. And it's never going to go away. But at the end of the line, we have people that are seeking for answers, people that, which is great, is they no longer trust the whole white coat model.
Yeah.
And people are now thinking for themselves and getting information and making educated, informed decisions. And I think this is where a lot of educated people go. And I think it's good to ask questions and criticize and really make decisions about your health. And I think when it comes to cholesterol, that's one where a lot of people have really become conscious and aware of, which is great. And it's good for you that you wrote your book and people are starting to understand that more.
Yeah, and we need more people like us who are willing to put the truth out there, because unfortunately too many people, going back to the statin drug example, you know, take those in their later years, 50s, 60s, 70s, and then start to have cognitive decline, and it's just chalked up to, oh, you're just getting older. So nobody thinks twice about the unintended consequence of those statins on their brain health.
Yeah, and I think you make a great point. And, you know, one of the things that's very, very scary is there's a trend in cardiology where they're trying to get cholesterol levels below 100.
Yeah.
And remember, cholesterol levels should be
LDL cholesterol.
Total cholesterol.
Oh,
total
really?
Cholesterol. Yeah, total cholesterol, which is, you know, usually around 180, 200.
Yeah.
There's a big movement right now, and I'm seeing this more and more in my practice. Patients coming in, and usually it's funny, when they go see the top people, like at major universities, the so-called best cardiologists, they're actually getting these cholesterol levels down to 100.
Oh.
But your brain needs cholesterol.
Yes.
Your endocrine system needs cholesterol. And this idiotic model has consequences beyond one variable factor associated with, you know, potential cardiovascular risk. And it's really, really sad to see that. But I think the whole model of just having one specialty where you only look through things through one filter really creates a problem for overall appreciation of human health and physiology, which is what we see. And it's no surprise that statins have been shown to do that.
There's people in this audience right now that have an HDL that's over 100 all by themselves. Wow.
Yeah.
That's craziness. I mean, well, that's where functional medicine, I think, comes into play, which is why I'm really glad you're one of those pioneers in this area. And you've now written the book, literally, on brain health, and I'm looking at it. Don't drop this on your foot, people, because it's 600 pages long. It's almost like a good calories, bad calories for your brain health. But
interesting thing. You know, when I finished the book, I didn't know how thick it was going to come out until I actually got the first copy. Then when I got the first copy of the book, I said, oh, no, this is too big. It's going to intimidate people. But then when I really thought about it, one of the things that makes that book so thick is I put 1,000 references in there.
Yes,
and
Gary did.
And what I wanted to do is I wanted to have those references in there just so because people know that here's what the information is really showing. You know, this is what these are mechanisms that have been published by researchers and non-pharmaceutical applications. And I wanted that in there. And I actually had many more references to put in. There's a point you have to, just say enough is enough. And also I put a lot of personal case stories in there for myself and other practitioners just to really connect with how this really impacts people from a real life scenario. And, you know, one of the lessons I learned from the thyroid book was that I needed to not make it so technical.
Right.
So there was a major attempt with this book to really simplify concepts. And, I think that's what we try to do with it.
And your brain just works that way. I could tell from reading the book, you like to be a little geeky about things. And some of us in this audience definitely appreciate that. When I was writing Cholesterol Clarity, I was thinking even more simplistic than even what you were thinking with this book. It's a tricky balance between you want to keep the integrity of the science, which you do provide 100 pages for people interested. 100 pages of this 600-page book is all references, so you can go look them up at your discretion. But you did do a good job, because I was reading on page 32, you gave the example of Ozzy Osbourne. He's a fascinating study in neurology. Whenever I watched his reality television show several years ago, I was amazed how he slurred his speech, needed to wear sunglasses indoors, and shuffled around. The years of drug abuse and life on the road had clearly taken their toll. However, once he got on stage in front of 50,000 people, all his finely tuned synaptic pathways for singing kicked back into gear, and he performed as if he were still in his 20s. Now, we can do better than Ozzy, not only perform well at the tasks that matter to us, but also stay sharp and active well into old age. So it's those kinds of stories you kind of sprinkle throughout Why Isn't My Brain Working to relate to people.
Absolutely. And when I wrote the thyroid book, I was criticized for putting case studies in there because of a gimmick of trying to do marketing. But when the book was first copy was done, I handed it to several of my patients to read. I asked them about the case studies, and they thought it was really, really important to just look at real life's issues. I mean, there's a point when you read and you just can't take any more information in, unless you can get a connection to emotional reality. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, when you look at the neurology of learning, we know that you can't learn to remember, or you can't remember anything until it goes into your temporal lobe. And you have to activate a part of your brain called the limbic system to make it go into that area. So when you hear information and you read information, that's your frontal cortex, the front of your brain working. But unless it goes into the temporal lobe, the area right around your ear level, you won't be able to put it into long-term memory. And there's a pathway that involves the hippocampus and limbic system, and that's activated when you have an emotional response. So, just think about it. The times we have events where we remember the most, they were very emotional events for us. So there was actually an attempt to have people learn the information more by getting a limbic response. So I sprinkled stories in there, some of them were emotional in real life, just so that the information could also sink in better.
Yeah, I love one of the examples is a lady that's been on this podcast. She was inspired by you, Dr. Johnny LeBay out of San Diego, California, and she told her story. And yeah, so it's personal stories. I think people can relate. You put stories in there and somebody says, hey, that's me.
Yeah. And, again, the stories plus evidence, because sometimes people say, well, if these are anecdotal stories, they don't really mean anything. Well, we're not
right.
Just saying anecdotal stories. We're reporting with evidence and how it's applied, and this is just the argument that we have. At the end of the day, review of the literature, personal experience, and just logic makes sense to people's health decisions. And unfortunately, we don't have that in the healthcare model.
I wanted to tell you about a brand new company I'm really excited about. They are Tendergrass Farms, a cooperative-style online grass-fed meat shop committed to making it convenient for customers to support family farmers that are doing it the right way. They offer an easy online way to access quality sources of delicious and nutritious meats for your healthy paleo, primal, and low-carb lifestyle. Tendergrass Farms has some amazing dry-aged, hormone-free grass-fed beef, GMO-free pastured pork, air-chilled GMO-free pastured chicken, and air-chilled GMO-free pastured turkey. Plus, you get free shipping to the lower 48 states on all orders over $199. And don't worry about the meat going bad on its way to your home. Tendergrass Farms personally makes sure it is packed well in dry ice so that it arrives perfectly frozen and ready to nourish your entire family. Call Tendergrass Farms at 1-800-929-1785 or visit grassfedbeef.org to place your order. Tendergrass Farms, sustaining family farms. Now, Davis, inflammation is a big part of what you talk about in your book, and I'm really happy to hear that. You know, inflammation, I think, is at the heart of just about every chronic health issue, whether you're talking about heart disease or brain health issues. It really is a big key. What's inflaming people?
Well, let me just add something there. Obviously, we know diet, lifestyle, and environment are all inflammatory triggers. So just from an environmental sake itself. We know that plastics, things like bisphenol A, we know that fire retardants that are now sprayed in all new furnitures, we know that formaldehyde, these things in the literature are very inflammatory, immune reactive.
Yeah.
We know that potentially hybridization of certain proteins in food and GMOs may be potentially inflammatory to some sense. And we know that we just have diets that are really rich in partially hydrogenated fats and inflammatory foods. And the combination of all these things just increase people's total level of inflammation. Now, inflammation that is in the body systemically also impacts brain. But, and I have a chapter in the book on neuroinflammation, and one of the things that's really interesting about brain inflammation is that bodily inflammation, meaning inflammation throughout the body, actually turns on brain inflammation. But the brain is very unique in how it responds to inflammation. So within the brain, there's two types of cells. There's neurons, which is involved with transmitting messages, but there's also cells called microglia. And these glial cells account for more than half the weight of the brain. So in a sense, more than half of the weight of the brain are actually immune cells, not really neurons. And these glial cells turn on from inflammation through diet, through nutrition, through lifestyle. But these glial cells don't really have an off switch.
Yeah.
So once they turn on, they stay on. And as every inflammatory consequence has an impact on the brain stays warm, stays in an inflammatory state, which then accelerates how neurons die off, because as these glial cells get activated, they create a reaction chemically, and surrounding neurons start to degenerate away. So just like eating a meal and getting tired and fatiguing, that insulin surge is very inflammatory to the glial cells of the brain. I mean, gluten has been shown another major inflammatory trigger to brain.
Mm.
So just some people that are eating grains all the time, overeating, getting that crash after they eat, they're basically turning on their brain inflammatory consequence. So it's really interesting. We also know there's studies now, and I've referenced a lot of those in the book, where gastrointestinal inflammation turns on brain inflammation.
Yeah.
And we know that hormone deficiencies turn on brain inflammation, and trauma to brain turns on head and inflammation. So there's so many different mechanisms that turn on brain inflammation. And, you know, when you look at the operative, so here's the thing, when you look at the literature, you look at the evidence, you try to find any type of approach to reduce brain inflammation, and there really is nothing in pharmacology that has been shown effectively to do it, with the exception of hormones for people that are hormone deficient. But there's tremendous amounts of literature on natural flavonoids. And certain flavonoids have specific abilities to dampen glial cells. So sometimes when people have brain inflammation, the key clinical symptom we see is just brain fog.
Mm-hmm.
And for brain fog, you know, they just can't get a thought. That's clear. They can't find the words. And many people experience brain fog after they eat sometimes inflammatory foods.
Wow.
They just don't think clearly for a while. And there's lots of papers now that have been published with different flavonoids that dampen glia, which can potentially, you know, decrease the inflammatory consequence people have. And if people have been suffering from chronic joint pain, inflammation, gastrointestinal issues, they really should consider attempts to decrease their brain inflammation. I know for me personally, the first thing I do when I wake up is I just load up with my antioxidants and flavonoids just as a routine part of my day.
Wow.
You know?
And that's really cool. And I love in that what you were just saying. You were talking about the connection between the gut and the brain, and I love that section where you talked about identifying an impaired vagus nerve and the gut-brain axis, and this whole vagus nerve, and doctors, that they totally ignore the gut-brain axis in patients with chronic health and gut complaints. They just don't know about it, and that you can actually improve the vagus nerve. Can you tell us what the purpose of the vagus nerve is and some of these interesting ways that you can strengthen it?
Absolutely, but let me give you a little background for some listeners. Okay, so what we have to realize is that the gastrointestinal tract doesn't work on its own, that it needs neurological input to function. And the gastrointestinal tract has its own nervous system. They call it the enteric nervous system. And there's a pathway from the brainstem that connects the brain to the gut called the vagus nuclei, then becomes the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is a projection from the brainstem to the gastrointestinal tract, and when it gets activated, you get an autonomic effect. So things like blood flow happen to the intestines, you get to have gastrointestinal motility, you get to move your food, and you get to release enzymes. So when you look at the physiology of how you release enzymes, and how you get blood flow to your intestines, and how you have motility and move your food, those are all neurological mechanisms. Now, we know that when people's brains start to degenerate, they lose the ability to fire into their vagus. And as many times as people start to degenerate, they get constipation, they get inability to make digestive enzymes, they can't get efficient blood flow to the gut, so they get leaky gut, intestinal permeability issues. And when they walk into, let's say, the conventional healthcare system, they could totally get ignored. When they walk into the alternative healthcare system, they're going to be diagnosed with yeast overgrowth syndromes or leaky gut or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And those things all exist, but they exist secondary to the brain not being efficient. So in that whole chapter, Retaining the Brain Gut Axis, we talk about the importance of the vagus. And you know, in examination, you can look at the palate and see if it moves, and you can listen to the abdomen. These are all things that have been done in the functional neurology model. And you can give people application. So one of the things, like we talked about in the book, is gargling. Gargling activates the muscles in the back of the throat. That activates the vagus.
Cool.
You have effects in the gut as well.
Salt water
and
or just plain water?
Just plain water.
Wow.
Just as long as you gargle, you get those palate muscles firing, and as you fire those palate muscles, you activate the vagus. Yeah.
Right.
And there's people that have had, chronic health gastrointestinal problems because the brain's unhealthy, and once you start to activate pathways, you get things to work. Just like, for example, if your arm was in a cast and it atrophied, you'd have to move it to get it to work again. Well, there's people who have had loss of activation to the vagus because the brain isn't working well, and they need to activate it to get some function back. So there is truly a brain-gut access, and it goes both ways. It goes from brain to gut and then from gut back to brain.
Hmm.
And in the literature, this is well known. I mean, brain-gut access is not a term I made up. It's in the scientific literature.
Right. The singing loudly one was the one I was happy about.
Yeah, and those are all the strategies to activate the vagus. You know, when you look at brain health, there's two parts to it. You have to stimulate the brain by actually activating it, and then you have to create a chemical environment where it's healthy. And the combination of both those things together have the best impact on brain health. So simply, without getting into details, just physical exercise has profound impacts on brain. It activates it, it gets blood flows to brain, and one of the things they recently have found is that when you exercise, you actually have release of neurons, what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF.
Yeah.
And BDNF keeps your neurons connected together and allows things to happen. There is no drug that we know about that changes BDNF. There is no nutrient that's been shown to change BDNF levels, just physical exercise, activity of any kind. People that are failing in mathematics and can't remember numbers, they need to do math. People that have poor balance, they need to work on their balance, because the consequences of those are far-reaching beyond just beyond the poor balance or being poor at math, you know. And many times people that have brain-related issues, they call it personality issues. I'm just bad at math. It's just my personality.
Mm.
No, you're bad at math because your left frontal cortex is not able to engage.
Right.
I just have bad balance. I've always had it. Well, you have bad balance because your cerebellum doesn't work, you know, or is not efficient. So these are things that typically happen with brain-related issues. People blame it on personality. People blame it on aging. But there's things that can be done about those, and that's what I try to discuss in the book.
Well, and all these kind of things we were talking about with the vagus nerve, another one, gag reflexes, and you liken it to doing push-ups for the vagus compared to gargling and singing loudly as doing sprints. I love kind of that imagery of exercise, because that's going to help people understand the why.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, sometimes you have to specifically activate pathways that make your gut move. And I'll have patients sometimes get a box of tongue blades and just do a gag reflex, not in the back of their throat so they injure it, but just pushing down on their tongue. And they push down on their tongue, and that makes that vagus nerve fire. And when that fire is, it's like doing a bicep curl. So if you have weak biceps, you got to do bicep curls. If you have a weak vagus, you got to start activating that pathway. And it's just one of the strategies we use with people who have chronic imbalances. And that's the key thing, I think, with, I think many people, I got feedback with the Brain Book. It's not the same stuff regurgitated all over again. You know, it's not just like, hey, you need neurotransmitters, take this neuro amino acid and take some fish oils. And I mean, this is, some very important information, I think, that's never been presented in the books before. And I think,
that's right.
And
from a micronutrient perspective, you know, this goes well beyond just food and macronutrients. From a micronutrient perspective, I mean, there's so many key brain health nutrients that people just aren't getting in their diet because they're not eating certain foods that would give them those key brain health nutrients. What are some of those things?
Well, let me kind of answer that in a different way, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm not a big believer in the micronutrient model as the answer to care. And let me explain what I mean by that. In my practice, every single chronic patient I see comes in with bagfuls of supplements. And I mean bagfuls of supplements.
Yeah.
Okay? So I don't clinically, in my world, see patients that just don't have a single nutrient. Because when I see them, they've spent hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of dollars per month just trying to take any new supplement to feel better.
Right.
Okay? So I think what I see as a clinician and what I try to address in the book is, before trying to find a single micronutrient deficiency, what is the mechanism? What is the physiological mechanism that causes the person's brain to decline? So maybe it's neuroinflammation. Maybe it's abnormal blood sugar dietary habits. Maybe it's neurological autoimmunity. Maybe it's gluten sensitivity. So I think for a lot of people, when they start to read books about nutrition or other things, they almost apply the same pharmaceutical model, single symptom, single drug. They want single symptom, single nutrient. But that's inefficient for many people. And it's really more important to understand what mechanisms are involved. So what I try to do in the Brain Book is, in the beginning of each chapter, I talk about symptoms associated with a certain mechanism instead of symptoms associated with a certain nutrient deficiency. So at the end of the day, it's hard for me to answer a question of which micronutrients you would need, because I truly don't practice that model. My model is, what's the mechanism and how do I use micronutrients or diet and lifestyle to impact that mechanism? And that's kind of where I approach things, and that's the way I think. So,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I think that's a good thing. And I know a big part of what you talk about here is the role fat plays in brain health. And, you know, we've been seeing a lot more in recent years of these kind of madmen that go out there and do really dastardly things. And you can't help but wonder, is that an unintended consequence of maybe a low-fat diet on our culture?
Well, again, I think we do have a low-fat culture, and I think people are diet foods are very, very popular, you know. But the brain does need fat. The brain needs essential fatty acids and fatty fishes and avocados, and it does need nuts, and it does need seeds. And I think that it's one of the things that is a major problem. There's without any question countless papers on the role of how important essential fatty acids are to the brain. And I think when people start to become fat phobic and start to deprive themselves of things that have healthy fats in them, then we have a major problem. And we see that with the spectrum of children all the way up to seniors with all types of very developmental disorders or neurological disorders. So, you know, it's good to have fats in your diet.
And we need
the good fats. I mean, we don't want the partially hydrogenated and processed fats. We need really good fats, you know. So, I think most people are more aware of that, but not enough.
Yeah, well, we're working on that message, my friend. We hammer that one pretty hard here. Well, speaking of a message that needs to be hammered hard, I'm glad that you put in here about Cyrex Labs running the food sensitivity panel, because I don't think enough people realize that the foods that they're sensitive to, they're just eating and saying, well, I'm okay, and yet they're not okay, and you can't really know until you test for this. Can you share how you use this in your clinical practice?
Well, one of the things we know is, and I talk about gluten sensitivity testing and the research and the mechanisms. Many people have, for example, food sensitivities, and in particular what seems to have a profound impact on brain is gluten sensitivity. And gluten is one of these things where they've actually found now in studies that there's what they call cross-reactivity, that the molecular structure of gluten is similar enough to what's called synapsin. Synapsin is a key protein structure in neurons that helps keep the integrity of the structure, mm-hmm. and also to GAD, which is a major enzyme for brain, and also to cerebellum tissue. So what they're finding that gluten is so similar in structure to the amino acid sequence of neurological tissue that there's a lot of inflammatory cross-reactivity responses that take place. And it doesn't have to be celiac disease. It just has to be gluten sensitivity. And in my book, I talk about how there's still a gap between what's being published and what practitioners think. There's practitioners that think that you still have to have full-blown celiac disease performed by gastrointestinal biopsy to have brain-related issues. And research is showing you don't. And we know that many people that have gluten sensitivity also have cross-reactivity with other fruits. So let me explain, because this is really, really critical. Cross-reactivity is a very, very important symbol. It's not simply food sensitivity. Food sensitivity is where you have just an antibody against something. Cross-reactivity is where you have a protein structure which has 3 to 4 amino acids in an identical sequence with each other. And when you have cross-reactivity, the immune system will react against that protein as if something else was there as well. So, for example, people eat gluten, and they cross-react also against neurological tissue. But there's also a cross-reaction between gluten and other foods, such as sesame. Sesame has been shown to cross-react with gluten. Mm-hmm. Rice has been shown to cross-react with gluten now. So people sometimes go on a gluten-free diet, and they eat rice and sesame, and they have these adverse reactions. And they don't understand it because they're supposed to be gluten-free, or if they go on a gluten-free diet, they still don't feel better. But in fact, the lab tests show they have that. So in the book, I try to discuss some of those things. I just recently worked with one of my mentors, Dr. Arista Vijnani, and we published a paper. We got acceptance for publishing a paper, and we looked at the random population, and we looked at gluten sensitivity and dairy sensitivity. We found in 20% of the random U.S. population, okay? Mm-hmm. Of that 20%, we found 10% of them had neurological autoimmunity lab markers.
Wow.
So it's a serious issue, and it's not associated with celiac disease.
Hmm. Wow. And yet how many people are just totally oblivious to that?
Everybody.
yeah.
Not everybody, but you know what I mean? I mean, there's too many people that are oblivious to that. And again, things are changing. Information's going out there. People are learning more. But food has profound impacts on our brain health.
Yeah.
But what's most scary about food is that it's profound linked to neurological autoimmunity, where certain foods can trigger the immune system to attack its own brain.
Yeah. And ironically, it's some of the very foods we're being told as a society to eat more of for our health.
Exactly. Especially milk and wheat.
Yeah.
A combination of those two things can be devastating. And you
wow.
know, it doesn't, if you were a healthcare practitioner and you work with autistic children, or you just happen to hang out in an autistic center for a day,
yeah.
you talk to parents, they would tell you unquestionably, without doubt, in their voice, that when they took the kids off dairy and gluten, there was dramatic changes in the child's performance.
Wow.
Across the globe, it's not just here. And I think for a lot of people, it's a real issue. And, you know, if you look at the school lunch requirements today, all school lunches provided by government funding, state funding, have to have gluten and dairy in there.
Right. Yeah, I had a reader recently, Dr. Krazin, you're going to be shocked by this, but they talked about how their five-year-old came home and said, Mommy, guess what they served for breakfast at school today? And, hold on to your hats here. A Twix bar. Because
oh
the graham
God.
Cracker qualified as a grain in their diet, and they had run out of the graham crackers. Well, it's got graham cracker in it, so therefore it's an equivalency to the graham cracker.
I know. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, we can literally talk for hours about all the great information you put in Why Isn't My Brain Working, but I have one more concept I had never seen before. That's always a good thing because I've interviewed hundreds of people on this show. I've heard of the leaky gut, but you put in here about the leaky brain. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So the gastrointestinal tract has a barrier system, and the brain has a barrier system. We basically have four barrier systems in our body. Our skin, which is the most obvious one.
Yeah.
We have our gastrointestinal tract. We have a lung barrier system, and we have a blood-brain barrier system. And the blood-brain barrier is breached. And many things have been published in the literature that cause breach of blood-brain barriers. One interesting paper that was published recently found we have that PCBs that are found in human water supplies can break down blood-brain barriers in animals, meaning that when they equate the two, they can see that we may even have breakdown of the blood-brain barrier from just environmental things in our water supply.
Wow.
We know stress breaks down the blood-brain barrier very, very quickly. People that are in chronic stress, they have a breach in the blood-brain barrier. And the goal of the blood-brain barrier is to keep particles out. But when the blood-brain barrier gets breached, you can have the proteins and particles and different pathogens that get into the brain. So here's an example. We all have elevated levels of environmental toxins. There's no question about it. If any one of us was to go through and do different types of testing, all of us would have high levels of either lead or mercury or arsenic or other types of things. That's just known as a fact. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the key concern is, do they actually get into the brain? Now, if you have elevated levels of those compounds, because we all do, you may not have any issues with it, but if you lose the integrity of the blood-brain barrier, now those types of things can enter your brain. And when they enter the brain, they turn on the glia, and they create inflammatory reactions. So now there's different models being published in the research model of how breakdown the blood-brain barrier is an initial trigger for development of neurological autoimmunity, things like multiple sclerosis and other types of conditions. And they're also now linking that Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease may have an autoimmune component. So you're kind of seeing this link between, you know, your blood-brain barrier breaks down, and then you have potential risk for your immune system to attack your own brain, and then those things can lead into autoimmune disease like MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, different types of dementias, or unknown named conditions.
Right. You know?
So it becomes very, very interesting. So I think the blood-brain barrier is going to be a very popular area as time comes on. In the literature, there's an explosion of it. They were able to identify blood-brain barrier protein several years ago. That had led to a lot of different research studies they can do in laboratory settings. And we can start to test for serum markers that show up when the blood-brain barrier breaks down. So there's going to be a lot more investigation and work with it as time goes on, but it is a real, real issue. Just like leaky gut is important, leaky brain is important too.
Wow. His name is Dr. Datis Karazian, the name of his brand new book, Why Isn't My Brain Working? A Revolutionary Understanding of Brain Decline and Effective Strategies to Recover Your Brain's Health. And we didn't even cover 1% of 1% of this book, guys. You've got to pick up a copy of it. It's really fantastic. He's got a website for it, brainhealthbook.com. And once you're there, he's got some sneak peek parts of the book. He's got different blog posts he's written on this subject. Patient stories are listed there, more about Dr. Karazian and more. So be sure to check out brainhealthbook.com. Well, Dr. Karazian, thanks so much for joining us again here today on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate it.
Coming up next time on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, we'll have Dr. Jason and Mira Calton.
Visit our website at thelivinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. And email us anytime at llvlcshow@gmail.com.